recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewList and friend of Jurnov. And welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit play on your iPod, iPad, computer, or whatever device you store these shows on. Today we have a real interesting show, which I'm thrilled to be doing. We're going to be drilling down into the meet and confer process and try to provide some advice about what works and what doesn't from the defense, plaintiff, and judicial perspective. By this time, most e-discovery attorneys are familiar with the entire cooperation movement pushed by the Sedona Conference and embraced by over 100 judges nationally, but I still believe that many litigators who encounter the meet and confer step into a litigation process, and they hear about cooperation, and they get that feeling like we're back in first grade and heading off to school for the first time, so they're not really comfortable, or they ignore it. And there still aren't enough war stories being told about positive outcomes from working with the other side through discovery components of a case before the adversarial process kicks in. And so today we hope to explore what works, what doesn't, and find out what Judge Waxy thinks about all this. So let me introduce my panelists today. Judge Waxy and I met at Georgetown's eDiscovery Conference a few years ago, and he said back then he'd do a podcast with me. So for those of you who periodically ask if we can do a show, don't take it personally. It sometimes takes me 2 years to schedule a show. This is a great example with Judge Waxy, who's a judge widely recognized by lawyers as being extremely progressive and a keen student of the field and the author of some of the most widely cited opinions in the field. So you can get a sense of the challenges I have balancing professional interests in e-discovery with this hobby. But Judge Waxy is a United States Magistrate Judge from the United States District Court in Kansas City, Kansas. He's authored several pioneering decisions in electronic discovery disputes, including Williams v. Sprint, United Management. He's interprets the scope of electronic discovery to include metadata, and Williams v. Sprint, United Management Company from 2006. Which was using the procedure created by the new federal rules of civil procedure to resolve issues of inadvertently produced electronically stored information. He's also an observer to the Sedona Conference Working Groups on Electronic Document Retention and Production, Working Group 1, and International Electronic Information Management Discovery and Disclosure, Working Group 6. He was a participant at the Duke Conference on Civil Litigation in May 2010 and has been a lecturer in law at the University of Kansas School of Law and has made presentations on electronic discovery and other topics and programs presented by the ABA, the American Association for Justice, Defense Research Institute, University of Kansas, University of Missouri at Kansas City, Washburn Law School, Georgetown, Kansas Bar Association, and Kansas Trial Lawyers Association. The list goes on and on. Widely spoken. He's also the author of Do I Really Have to Do That? Rule 26A1 Disclosures and Electronic Information, which was published in the Richmond Journal of Law and Technology back in 2004, and Trends in Discovery of Electronically Stored Information from the ACC docket in January, February 2007. Great to have you on the show, Judge Waxy, and Bennett Borden is a first-time speaker on ESI Bytes. Our paths crossed in the analytics world of eDiscovery, so I'm pleased to finally have my friend Bennett on an ESI Bytes podcast. Bennett co-chairs William Mullen's eDiscovery and Information Government section. He's a litigation attorney who focuses his practice on electronic discovery and information law, in addition to conducting both offensive and defensive electronic discovery in complex litigation. Bennett has extensive experience counseling clients on the establishment of information governance and records management policies, procedures, and practices based on enterprise risk assessments. He regularly advises multinational clients regarding data privacy, data security, and data regulatory compliance. Prior to joining Williams Mullen, Bennett served as chair of the Electronic Data Discovery Initiative and is a member of the steering committee for the Electronic Discovery and Information Law Practices Group of a respected global law firm. He's a member of the steering committee for the electronic discovery section of the District of Columbia Bar. He's a frequent speaker on the topic of electronic discovery and information governance and the author of many articles. He's a guest lecturer on e-discovery law at the Georgetown University Law Center and a member of Working Group 1 on Electronic Document Retention and Production, as well as chair of the Cloud Computing Drafting Group for the Sedona Conference. He's also vice chair of the Electronic Discovery and Digital Evidence Committee of the Science and Technology Law Section of the ABA. Our final guest, Megan Jones, is a partner at Hostfeld and a past guest on ESI Bytes. We're pleased to have her here because she's also in the third trimester of pregnancy, and she's the third guest who's done this on our show and not had a child despite scheduling it. So, Megan, we're thrilled for that achievement. But Megan specializes in recovering damages for corporate victims of antitrust cartels. Recoveries from the cases she's been involved in total over $500 million. In 2010, Megan was the only female antitrust attorney who had two of her cases featured in the National Law Journal's Plaintiffs Hot List, which named the top 12 plaintiffs law firms in the U.S. In 2011, the Legal 500, which provides comprehensive worldwide coverage on legal services, recommended her for having a good understanding of business and operational environments. Megan is recognized as a specialist in antitrust civil enforcement for victims of cartels and has been asked to speak by many prestigious legal organizations on this topic, including by the Bar Associations of Germany and Australia. So great to have you all on the show, and I always like to start off with a first question. How did each of you get started in electronic discovery? And why don't we start with you, Judge Waxy, and then Megan, and then Bennett.
Well, mine was easy because I got arbitrarily assigned a case that had e-discovery issues in it. And the sad thing was this was back, I think, in 2001. I didn't know a thing about it, so I had to learn. And from then on, I've gotten several cases, and each time I've had to learn more. And when you happen to write the first opinion in an area, suddenly they think you're an expert, whether the opinion was right or wrong. So then I became a speaker, and from there.
Okay, and Megan?
Well, mine is similar in that I, as an associate, got 10 years ago arbitrarily assigned to a case with a lot of ESI issues. It was on the cusp of the paper-electronic divide, and faced with the case with 1.5 million paper documents looking at a warehouse and a team of 10 reviewers in 4 months, I realized that going line by line was not going to be possible. And so that first case, I kind of started adopting electronic search methods, and since then it's been de rigueur for my cases, okay, given the volume.
Well, let's start off now by talking about meet and confers. And first, Judge Waxy, can you explain the cooperation requirements, you know, where they come from and what's ideally supposed to happen at this stage of the process?
Well, I think they come from the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. If you look, there are various rules that require elements of cooperation. And they also come from a recognition by various courts that if we're going to get to just, speedy, and inexpensive determinations, it's essential that lawyers cooperate in the discovery process to get to that end. And, you know, one of the things we just discussed at the Sedona meeting last week is the fact that I had made a proposal that we get more specific in Rule 1 to say, right now Rule 1 says, the rules shall be administered and construed by the court to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive. And my position was, we ought to put the obligation on counsel as well as the court, and it shows what happens when you don't carefully read all the comments, because there's a comment to the 1993 amendments that says, as officers of the court, attorneys share this responsibility with the judge to whom the case is assigned, that responsibility being to ensure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination. So I think what hopefully will happen to the rules, we move that comment up into the rule, and then we put in the comment the explanation of how cooperation is the essential way of getting this done.
So, Megan, from the plaintiff's perspective, why do you think it was necessary for the Sedona Conference to come out with a cooperation proclamation?
I think that from the plaintiff's perspective, it was necessary to show that there was judicial support for what we were saying at the time. Not all plaintiffs, but at least what those near in my practice were. We would enter these meet and confers and try to get a quantum of information about what was going to be produced before it was produced. And we would meet a wall of resistance from counsel saying, propound your document requests, and then we'll talk. And, you know, we would try to reverse engineer and say, you know, we can limit the amount of production if we can actually talk about what you have and what's relevant. And, you know, the example I always like to give is if you have a business unit in your company that has nothing to do with my case, and I can agree on that with you because you've disclosed it to me in a meet and confer, you don't have to search that entire set of documents. And it was necessary, I think, for the cooperation proclamation to be put forward to show that there are judges who understand that this kind of informal exchange before documents or ESI is produced is useful.
And Bennett, you get a chance as to add your perspective as a rebuttal, because I know defendants sometimes feel like e-discovery was created as some type of karma for every document dump ever done when we lived in a world of paper. So what's your perspective on why the Sedona Conference had to come out with a cooperation proclamation?
You know, I agree with both Judge Waxie and Megan that it's a recognition that in the information age, our discovery processes weren't working, and they were frankly overwhelming the justice system and the cases we worked with. The mere fact of it is that the litigation is by its nature adversarial, and because of that, the idea of cooperating, it was just not one that was natural for many attorneys. But because of the vast amount of information, the communications we have among the parties to be able to figure out how to get to the small slice of information that actually matters, that those conversations become critical so that you can actually inform each other about what actually matters and focus our efforts on getting to that. And then we can get the facts from those, and then we can argue about how those facts actually play out in the merits of the case itself. But it doesn't behoove any party to not have this cooperative conversations in a world awash of information.
You know, now, you know, there's not oftentimes the opportunity to talk about how this process works, you know, tangibly. So I wanted to ask each of you, when do you see this process working? Because it can help an audience of doubters when they hear examples of how this actually works when parties cooperate. So can you give an example of when you saw this work, first starting with you, Judge Waxie, and then Megan and Bennett?
Well, the clearest examples I've seen is in situations where I've sort of forced or coerced or whatever you want to label it, cooperation. What I've done on occasion that's kind of getting to be an old story is I've had situations where lawyers come in and say, we just can't get this resolved, and it seems to me to be something that should be easily resolved if you got in a cooperative mode. And so I've told them to go back, do it again, but this time I want it videotaped, and you either send me an agreement or the videotape, and then I'll decide what the problem is. And I'm able to say I've not ever had to look at a videotape, but I have to disclose that I've had some fellow judges complain that they've followed my suggestion and then been stuck with long videotapes. But my experience has been that generally it works, and the humorous response I got from one lawyer I was on a panel with when I said, this works, I don't know why. He said, well, it's pretty easy, Judge. It's like physics. Particles in physics change when observed, and so do lawyers. And that, I don't know, again, I'm not sure that's why it works, but it does work. And so I think the key is to get lawyers to sit down and really talk about resolving the problem as opposed to the game playing that often goes on in litigation, especially in discovery. And it just seems to me it's in the client's best interest as well as the system's best interest if we don't waste a huge amount of time and money fighting about things that should be able to be resolved cooperatively.
Well, Megan, how about yourself? Have you seen this work?
I have, and It's what's interesting is that it's becoming more systematized. And what I would point to as a huge success and time saver is the routine enforcement of judges requiring parties to do ESI disclosures. And for those who don't know what those are, it's usually a 5-point order that says you have to disclose who your likely custodians are, what documents in ESI they had, a description of the ESI, and any inaccessibility problems that you have to have, or that you anticipate having, and why you anticipate having them. That's a key point. And this is in writing, and it's usually done within 30 days of an answer. And I've seen, in my cases, that's the kind of information that I would usually ask for and have to fight for and may not get until after documents are produced. Getting this information before, knowing that there's 18 custodians versus 200, or I think there should be 75 and they're only disclosing 5, saves months of time. And so I think that the judges are understanding that making lawyers do comply with this kind of obligation will save them time, because you have a written record and it's verified by lawyers about who has likely documents. And if it comes up later that you know in discovery or at a deposition that you find something else or someone else who has relevant information, you have a basis to go back and ask for more. And so I think that the more systemic and routine this kind of exchange becomes, it will take it out of the adversarial realm, which we live in as lawyers, admittedly, and make it part of the Rule 1 expectations, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure expectations, that lawyers, it's just part of what you do. And there won't be a client hurdle on either side of the V to provide this information.
Bennett, have you seen situations where this works real well?
Absolutely. Carl, I practice in federal court and state court all over the United States, and I have seen a real sea change, especially in the last 2 years, as the idea of at least translucent, if not transparent, e-discovery processes have come into play. I've been especially heartened by how positively it's received on the other side of the V. The meet and confer process is an ongoing process. It usually takes several, 4, 5, 6, 10, whatever, conversations as you work with the other side to understand the people who are involved, the kinds of data they can create, and how to narrowly and proportionally target that information to get to the facts. It's what I have found more often is that it's not that the other side is unwilling, they simply aren't really familiar with how do you operationalize this. And so I've developed really a script that's based off of some very good work. You know, Judge Waxy's court has a very good ESI protocol. The Seventh Circuit has their pilot program. The Fifth Circuit has information. Judge Grimm's web in the District of Maryland, their website has a wonderful kind of script to go through. And as you talk with lawyers on the other side, it's quite apparent that they understand the pain and cost of excessive discovery. And so I have found really great success in being able to approach the other side with a logical way of addressing the information. Sometimes it takes a little while, a phone call or two for the other side to understand that you're really trying to be quite open and honest and you're not playing a trick on them. But once you get that piece down, I've been very heartened by how well this works.
You know, I'll add to that list, since I've done some international podcasts, Senior Master Whitaker in England and Chris Dale have this e-disclosure project. And, you know, dealing with information over is not unique to our system. Anyone that litigates or goes through an adversarial process with the same issue. So that's a nice form that they've put together as well.
Carl, can I add one more
sure.
thing? I think we have been focusing on ESI, but to me, the essential first step of cooperation in litigation, whether it's got ESI or not, but most importantly, if it does have ESI, is counsel need to sit down and decide what are the issues that are in dispute in this case. Because discovery only relates to issues unless you've got a court order saying you can go to subject matter or you have an agreement. And when I force lawyers to tell me what issues these discovery disputes relate to, I realize sometimes they haven't talked about that. And if you start out not looking at issues, but looking at custodians or looking at search terms or looking, you know, you really can't determine what are the search terms, what are the custodians, until you figured out the issues. And the important thing in, that fits with cooperation is oftentimes when I finally get a list of issues, it becomes clear some of them are not in dispute. And yet I'll have discovery disputes about an issue they really don't have a dispute about. So if you sit down in a cooperative mode and try and narrow the issues and in good faith say, well, you know, I really don't have a dispute about this issue, but it's this one that's key, that by itself is the first place that cooperation can really start impacting the amount of work you've got to do in the discovery area.
Oh, good point. So to switch things up a little bit, I'm going to switch the order here, but I'd like to talk about when does this break down, because, you know, it still doesn't work uniformly well across cases. So, Bennett, when do you see cooperation breaking down? And if you want to sort of expand on that.
You know, most of the trouble that I run into runs into a couple of places. One is where the other side simply, as Judge Waxy said, isn't aware either of the issues in the case or haven't done the necessary homework to be able to consciously address how information, the discovery that I'm seeking, applies to those claims. Lawyers don't like to feel stupid or be made to feel stupid. And I have found that one of the crucial pieces to make this work is setting up an environment where it's okay for the other side to say, I don't know, or to get help on how to find out the information I'm looking for. And so part of it is just a cultural thing and an experiential thing on the other side, and making sure that you set up a circumstance that this kind of open communication can occur. The other issue I've run into, you can tell when there's problems on the other side, either with a case or with a client or with certain facts, when true obfuscation starts to occur. And so really where the cooperation starts to fall down, I see, is when there's just real issues on the other side, either with a loss of evidence or they can't get answers out of a client. And there you have to set up the how do you cooperate with the uncooperative kind of strategies. I mean, our goal, of course, is always to try to resolve it among ourselves, but your ultimate arbiter is, of course, the court. And so how do you go about documenting what steps you have done and what reasonable proposals you're starting that you've developed, so that if you have to, in the worst case, go to the court, you've got those things well documented and can prove up why your approach is reasonable and is a narrowly targeted way of getting at what you're looking for.
Good. So, Megan, how about your perspective on this when it breaks down? Do you see other examples or?
Yeah, I think mainly from a plaintiff's perspective, the meet and confer process breaks down when it stretches into month 4, month 5, month 6, and documents still aren't produced, which is actually still happening. And so people want to abandon the process and just say, you know, I'm just going to serve these document requests and get what I get and deal with it later, because the information exchange is so slow that we've got a discovery schedule that's ticking away while we're trying to negotiate this. There are complex issues. It takes several weeks between each call so that everyone can go back and check on each side. And I think it's a pressure point in the length of these cases, that how long it takes from the first meet and confer until document one is produced. How I've dealt with that is document. Every request that for meeting and conferring that I make, and how long it takes for them to get back to me. I think a trend that I'm seeing in the class action world, you know, plaintiffs sue multi-party defendants 5, 10, 13, is what's happening is that they'll say, we want to discuss global objections first. And that's objections we all maintain to all of your document requests. And we say, okay, wonderful. But we'd like to discuss your specific objections as well, and defendants refuse to do so. And so you spend month 1 or 2 on the global objections, and then you start each defendant by defendant objection. Well, we don't believe in this term, or we don't have this document, and then all of a sudden you're in month 6 or 7, and you're still negotiating, and people's tolerance has evaporated. And so I see that as a trend that is undercutting how efficient this could be, and it's difficult to get a court's attention that early in the case with that scant record, saying, you know, it takes 3 weeks for them to get back to me, Judge, between every call. Well, we have 13 defendants, and we have to coordinate, and understandably, Your Honor, we're multinational corporations, and boards have to vote on what we, you know, respond to and produce to defendants, you know, to plaintiffs, and it takes forever. And so it's hard to sustain a spirit of cooperation when, you know, it's stretching on that long, and a refusal to cooperate or discuss issues simultaneously. It seems like there's a shoot, and they're willing to discuss one issue, and then we'll get to those other ones later. And so I see it as kind of a device that's dragging out this kind of meet and confer process.
So you've got two new ones in there, Judge Waxy. We already talked about identifying the issues, but I think Bennett also mentioned a problem on one side, like maybe loss of evidence or a problem client. And then Megan talked about timing. Do you have any reaction to the steps you as a judge can take to encourage cooperation?
Well, one of the things that sort of came to my attention was back during the Duke conference, we were having this discussion about cooperation, and there were several general counsel of major corporations there, and one of those general counsel asked me on the panel I was on, well, what do you do if your lawyer doesn't want to cooperate? And she was talking about the counsel she'd hired. And my quick answer was, well, that's very easy. You're in charge of this. If you tell your lawyer you've hired to cooperate, I think they're going to cooperate. But then I started thinking about that because she agreed that was probably a simplistic but good approach, that if counsel were told to cooperate by their clients, because it's in the client's interest in so many cases to cooperate and cut down on the time and cost, it's more likely to happen. So what I've done since then, on some of our cases, when we do the initial case management conference, I've been requiring clients to sit in on the telephone call. And one of the things we talk about is cooperation and why it is so essential to getting to just, speedy, and inexpensive to have that kind of attitude, so that I can get the message directly to the clients. And, you know, I don't want to be too cynical, but there are clearly some circumstances where you almost get in a conflict situation, because litigation attorneys, and especially in those cases where it's symmetrical and both sides are billing on an hourly basis, you know, it's almost in the attorney's best interest from a financial point of view to continue these disputes, not to cooperate and get them over with. So you've got to get the word across to the attorneys and the clients. This is not a game or a method just for lawyers to make money. This is a litigation system where we've got to quickly and inexpensively resolve these things.
Yeah, I have an observation in that area. One of the things I've seen is when you try to get in-house lawyers more focused on the nuts and bolts, they still tend to be focused more on what are the meaty issues that are coming out of the process, instead of how are the resources being allocated. It's just really hard to get in-house people excited about the nuts and bolts. But that's where that's where these pain points are coming from.
Well, and Carl, this has been a, that raises a really good point. I mean, one of the things that's happened with eDiscovery is that it's almost become a separate process divorced from the rest of litigation. The volume of information has kind of pushed this industry of lots of processing, a large review that's kind of pushed into the hands of contract attorneys often. So there's this plowing through documents that then get reviewed by the next level of probably in law firm folks, and then a smaller set finally get up to the decision makers. And it's because of that, it's lost its focus, which is really understanding the underlying facts about what happened and why it happened. And so what I find is so the nuts and bolts piece you're talking about is it's this perception that the nuts and bolts are somehow separate, as opposed to being this truly critical piece of what litigation is about. And so a lot of what I do, both with my clients and in the meet and confer process, is focus the discussion around how do we find the facts that are going to drive the resolution of this case. All of us know that while there may be, you know, a million documents that are all docs concerning anything in the electronic age, it's really, you know, from 0.5% to 1% of those documents that actually matter. So shouldn't our attention be focused on, through the meet and confer process, scraping off that little layer of 1% to see if we can get the resolution and not go to the burden and expense of the 99%?
You know, Carl, another piece of this that I certainly use when I've got clients on the phone as well as counsel is you've got to put this in the perspective that in federal court in the United States, on civil cases, less than 1% of them go to trial. And the idea of discovery is to get the information generally you need to try the case, because in terms of analyzing it for settlement, that's a lot smaller burden than getting evidence that you need to try the case. And if you focus on the goal is to resolve the case, if possible, on the merits, not on who's got the most money, and realize that the odds are you're not going to try this case, I think it can get you focused on looking for solutions up front, not only on what issues are not in dispute, but okay, we've now narrowed the issues. What are the potential risks here, and how much is it going to cost, and how long is it going to take, and doesn't it make sense to really talk about settling it now as opposed to having this battle?
I love both your answers, because they didn't tie to a question of mine, and they both lead to advanced analytics. Which is my focus, but having said that, you know, that's definitely a topic for another show. But you know, I love your. In fact, one of the reasons I reached out to you, Judge Waxy, is we have a group here in that, you know, there are a couple of cities that do it called Friends of eDiscovery, where we meet between judges and in-house lawyers and outside lawyers and just talk once a quarter about problems that we see in the space. It's not adversarial. It's an opportunity to just talk about, is this working or not, among people in the field. And I should mention, this is something that Pete Pepitone and Tom Ullman started in Cincinnati, and Columbus does it, and we do it in Pittsburgh. But in our last meeting, we specifically talked about your videotape idea. And videotaping meet and confers. And Judge Conte in the Western District thought that it was an outstanding idea. You said it works for you, but sometimes it's not working for others. Any advice you can offer? Because I think this gets right to the he said, she said issue of exposing when you have a problem. So how do you make it work?
Well, you know, mine has evolved a little bit, because what I've done in the last three or four cases where I've had these complex disputes over numerous issues, instead of me trying to resolve the disputes, I've set them for hearing, and then I call these hearings Mancia hearings. And if you haven't read the Mancia decision that Judge Grimm wrote, you may not understand this. But what I do is I start the hearing by giving them a copy of Mancia, because I've discovered very few lawyers have actually read it. And then I tell them, before we start the hearing, I want you to read this opinion, because it's going to guide what we're going to do in the hearing. And then I leave the courtroom, but leave a law clerk in there. And each time I've gotten the same report from the law clerk, it's clear most lawyers have not read it. And it's also clear as they read it, they become more and more frightened about their own situation. Because what Mancia talks about is Rule 26G, which says the court shall sanction people that violate this rule. And so much of the disputes in e-discovery, it appear to me, are clear violations of 26G, which includes, you know, not making reasonable requests and not making reasonable responses and not focusing. So what I do then in these so-called Mancia hearings, I go back in and say, all right, you've read the case. I not only have read the case, I've read your pleadings and looked at these disputes, and there are numerous 26G violations in this case. And my starting point is going to be $1,000 sanction per violation. And I haven't kept an accurate count of who's going to get the most, but both sides are going to get some. But rather than just start sanctioning you, I'm now going to give you a chance to see if you, in a cooperative mode, can't resolve these. And this is where it ties back into the earlier videotaping, because what I then point out is, contrary to the normal public perception, every federal courtroom in America has cameras already. There's security cameras, and then I point them out up in the ceiling. And I point out that I have talked to the United States Marshal's Office, and these in our digital age are downloaded to a server, and they are very happy to give me a copy of the whatever I want out of my courtroom. So I tell them, you know, you're being videotaped and recorded, but I'm going to give you a chance now to see if you can't resolve these disputes without me having to sanction anybody. And I leave them again in the courtroom with a law clerk. And as I say, I've done this 3 or 4 times now. I think one time I had to rule on 1 out of 8 motions that were pending. The rest of the time, they have been able to work these out. And, you know, just to give you an example, I'll get requests that are fairly specific, like we want all documents related to this meeting. And I get a response because they're using form objections that the request is vague. You know, there's no way that's vague. And that's a 26G violation when you use those kind of form responses. Or you'll get a request for all information regarding the litigation. Well, that's clearly too broad, which is a 26G violation. And so if we can get people to get focused, and sometimes it needs to be in the courtroom under a camera, they really are able to work these things out. They know what they should be doing. It's just so easy. And sometimes I don't think it's even intentional. I think it's just the trial lawyer says to the young associate or legal assistant, you know, I need a set of form requests and interrogatories, and the same thing happens on the other side. So they just pull out forms that try and be broad enough to cover every possible problem, and they don't fit in the case. So that's kind of a long answer about another way of dealing with the problem.
So, Bennett, you know, one of the issues that I've seen out here is the disparity in comfort with e-discovery. And there are times when we, you know, we think if we know the field that we have an upper hand with an adversary. And in that situation, pushing for cooperation can become a challenge. Can you really cooperate effectively with attorneys who don't get e-discovery, or maybe it's their first time doing e-discovery? I mean, do you share the cooperation proclamation?
You know, and it varies. And look, all of us on the phone here, and Carl, you as well, have been involved in e-discovery for years and years. And it's just not, you know, reasonable for us to figure out that other people are going to be as good as we are. It's just not. And so I find sometimes people get frustrated when they have people on the other side who are not as sophisticated at this, but that doesn't really help either. And so what I have found is really most helpful is to provide the means by where they can cooperate. And so part of it is helping frame the conversation with agendas in advance. Often what I will do is set up a series, always, almost always, 3, 4, 5 of these, meet and confers, each one, because they never have the information you need the first one. They just don't. And so before the first one, I send out an agenda and a list of topics and what we're both parties are going to bring to the table. We come and have that initial meeting, that informs the next step, and that informs the next step. And I have found that if you provide the means by which they can cooperate, it's much, much more effective. I have very rarely run up against truly obstinate opposing counsel. And when you do, frankly, you let them feel the pain of their own choices, whether it's you can't agree on specific search parameters or terms or whether certain custodians or not, and you prove up the reasonableness of your position, and then if you have to take it to the court, you do. And after one of those, that tends to solve the problem. But again, I find making sure that you provide them the means by which they can zealously represent their client by being cooperative is the means to success.
Interesting.
I would echo that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Megan, if you, from your perspective, how do you coach?
I have a couple form letters in my files that explain the most recent case decisions on ESI search terms or the obligation to meet and confer that I send defense counsel or opposing counsel when they refuse to cooperate or meet and confer. And I actually have had counsel refuse to meet and confer. And once they see the case law has caught up with this in this area of law that it's across the country, it's pretty widespread, It's well accepted. The old gotcha game of discovery just isn't playing well in the courts these days, and I find that that helps to form that record in writing, saying this is what's obligated, and if you choose not to cooperate, I'm going to present your position along with this case law to the judge. And so I have, like I said, a couple of form letters on several ESI and meet and confer issues that I send that kind of lays that out and allows people to get educated quickly.
Great. Well, now I'm going to launch a last question on each of you that, you know, I've had listeners say, I love the first question because a lot of our speakers do panels all over the country, and you seldom get to hear how people got started in e-discovery. So the next, I think, new question is to give everyone a chance just to give a perspective right now at this point in time. You know, what are you seeing as the most likely interesting trends in e-discovery space at this point in time, which is, you know, October of 2011. So, Judge Waxy, if you want to weigh in on that, and then Megan and then Bennett.
I mean, I think the trend that I see and hope continues is that lawyers are going to get comfortable with technology, and that has many ramifications. I mean, we've talked a little bit about how you have to know what your issues are and know where the facts are that control that. You know, data maps and technology can help you with that. When you get to the next step of how do I gather this stuff, how do I search for it, there is absolutely no question that technology is the solution there. The thought that there are still some lawyers saying, well, I don't trust technology, I'm going to have either somebody in my firm or a contract attorney or somebody, some person, go look at all this stuff, is absolutely ridiculous, because the volumes are such, most cases you cannot afford to do that with the volumes of data that exist. So you've got to get your comfort level up in regard to technology. And you have to be careful, though, because there are some technologies that don't work very well. And, you know, we've already had some discussion in this period of time today about, well, we need agreement on custodians and search terms. And I think we're going to find, as technology progresses, neither of those concepts are going to be key in the future. What you need to get focused on, once you've determined what the issues in dispute are, is what are the likely sources of information, not who. Because there are so many information systems that don't tie it to an individual. You know, you may discover that all the emails have been put on a server someplace else and the individual keeps hardly any of them. Or you may discover that there's no individual involved in the creation of certain data. There are automatic data collection systems that are gathering that. So if you're focusing on custodians and the key information in your case isn't tied to a custodian, that's not been the way to go. And it just seems to me that when we look at search terms, that, and there have been several opinions written about this, that is really not the most effective way of finding information. You know, lawyers are trained at least to use computer search techniques with Lexis or Westlaw or whatever you use, and so they're comfortable with that, and so search terms fit within the comfort level. But if you start looking at the studies comparing search terms to other forms of searching for ESI, search terms are down pretty low compared to the good stuff you can really use these days. And so I think as technology develops and lawyers get confidence in it, that's going to help us get to just speeding and expensive.
Okay, Megan?
I think the trend that will confront both lawyers and judges is timing. And we haven't agreed on it yet, and I don't see a resolution easily made on the horizon, but how long should we spend in meet and confers, and how much judicial resources should be spent to make sure that this is a process that lasts 4 months versus 8 months? In terms of a trajectory of a case, are you supposed to spend the first year? We all understand that identifying, you know, correct information at the meet and confer drives the case. You have to decide on the issues. You have to decide on where the relevant documents are. The question that we're going to have to resolve amongst ourselves as attorneys and ultimately I think the courts are going to have to weigh in is how long should that take? You know, what kind of resources? Is it okay to wait a month between meet and confers because it takes that long? Or, you know, is it, you know, as Judge Waxy has suggested, a Rule 1 issue under the federal rules that we actually need to devote more resources to get to it quickly? I think that's going to be an issue that, while not decided yet, will confront us in the next couple of years.
That sounds like a perfect another show on ESI Bites, but since it ties directly into meet and confers, Bennett or Judge Waxy, do you have do you want to weigh in on that timing issue?
Yeah, I mean, timing is a critical issue in these cases. And we've seen the amendments to the federal rules in 2006 have already very much affected the timing of a case. It used to be that how we did cases, well, you know, someone files a complaint, someone files an answer, you go through the motion to dismiss, and then you finally get to discovery and thinking about it. Under the new rules, you've got to be, as soon as you have a triggering event, you've got to be right on top of the data and get in. You can't participate in these meet and confers. You can't get an ESI protocol, preservation agreements, any of it in place without getting way ahead of the data. So the timing has already affected this. And, you know, frankly, I think that timing issue is going to become even more critical by the sooner you have control or governance of your data, the better you can engage in this process.
Yeah, and I think one of the big conflicts within the court system right now is there are some courts and judges that focus entirely on and what I think is just an arbitrary number that, by God, we're going to get every case over with in this many months. Mm-hmm. And there are other courts and judges that say, you got to analyze the case and figure out, is this a case that can be done that way? And there are cases that easily fit within those guidelines. But there are other cases that, when you really look at what the issues are and how much data there is to get resolved, it's going to take a lot longer. So you got to be flexible about that time. And then I think, you know, there's a clear tendency among trial judges that the old cliche that the best way to get a case over with is give it a firm, quick trial setting, and because they can't get it ready, they'll settle it. You know, to me, our focus ought to be trying to resolve the case on the merits, not on who can get ready quicker. And so I don't think it's appropriate for courts to take that position. You know, it gets back again to just, speedy, and inexpensive, but speedy doesn't control all of it.
Okay, great. Now, Bennett, you get the last crack at the big issue that you see out there.
Well, you know, look, I am very optimistic about this whole process. And the two trends that I see are kind of interrelated. One is, look, cooperation is working. The area of e-discovery law has, thanks in large part to the work of judges such as Judge Waxy, especially the Sedona Conference, where the granularity of the principle of proportionality that has developed in a scant 5 years across many jurisdictions is really quite astounding for the pace of the law and how it develops. And so I'm seeing that work. I think that trend will continue. I think that trend is going to start to be focused on the other big problem we're all facing, which is preservation. As we all know, that's what the Sedona Conference is about. There was a mini conference for the Rules Committee to discuss the challenges of preservation. And what I see is that the ideas that we have developed in the proportionality world through Rule 26 are going to start to be applied to the preservation space. I think that practitioners can further that by consciously addressing preservation agreements and getting them entered as part of the ESI protocols and ESI orders, to give examples to folks about how you can get those proportionality principles to apply to the preservation area. The other big trend that I see is a move toward lessening the e-discovery burden through better information governance. What drives the burden of e-discovery is that companies don't know where their information is or what's in it. If I have to go find a document that's ungoverned, meaning I don't know where it is and I don't know what's in it, it costs anywhere from $3 to $5 for me to go find that document, figure out what it is, and decide whether to produce it and produce it. For information that's governed, meaning I do know where it is and I do know what's in it, basically, it costs between 3 cents and 50 cents. That is driving a huge trend, what I see in corporate America, especially for companies outside of the litigation context to put the work in to go through what I call an information governance review, but to understand how to create just enough information, keep it just as long as it's useful, and to get rid of it when it's not. If that those pieces are in place, it drives this, the e-discovery makes it much easier. And that, I think, is critical. We've got a window here where getting better control of corporate information is going to be easier now than it is even in the few upcoming years. As Judge Waxy pointed out, the information isn't as easily created by a person or identified to a person. With social media and collaboration websites and location data tied to opinions and concepts, the data environment is becoming much, much trickier. And so establishing a culture of understanding the information a company creates and governing it from the beginning, if we do that now, it will make e-discovery of this new kind of information easier in the future.
Great. Well, I love that. I love all of your answers. I think this is a keeper, is a question for the show, because, you know, very thought-provoking, each of you. So I'd also like to thank each of you, Judge Waxy, Megan, and Bennett, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI Information, which is how it sounds out. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewList, wishing you a nice day.